You're listening to the Kumek Podcast, hosted by our teacher development team. Enjoy!
Welcome, Eva. I am delighted to have you on our MedEd podcast today. I feel like I can't do you justice. Do you want to introduce yourself for our audience today?
Hi, everyone. My name is Eva Echo. My pronouns are she, they. I'm an activist, writer, public speaker, also director of innovation at Birmingham Pride, and I sit on the Crown Prosecution Service's hate crime panel. I'm really excited to be here and be part of this podcast.
Thank you. You're probably as busy as GPs and educators and medical students who are juggling lots of work, really busy, but in fact, your timetable sounds perhaps even busier. It's not a competition, but I'm just aware of how many different roles that you have. And sorry, for those that don't know me or haven't listened to the podcast before, I'm Renee Paul. I'm a GP in North London and one of the teacher development leads at King's, working with the undergraduate medicine programme, and my pronouns are she, her. And I was thinking yesterday, Eva, having met you before, you've spoken to our GP teachers at an annual conference we run, you've spoken to our medical students, and I think one of the things that really has come across for me is for our students, hearing your story has been so powerful. So I wondered if you could tell the audience and the listeners a little bit about yourself and your story.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I came out 5 years ago as transgender, and that was the culmination of many, many years of denial, mental health illnesses, all sorts, because I knew from quite a young age, around the age of four, that I won't say that I knew I was trans, because back then that word wasn't in my vocabulary. I knew that I felt difference compared to everybody else at school. When you're a child, you don't think much of it at the time. It's only as you grow up and you start seeing the world and you start having all these responsibilities and labels put onto you that you then realise that's not me. My first experience was, I was on a family holiday and was staying with some relatives, and I was having a bath. My mum asked me to dry myself when she went down to help my aunt with the cooking. So she left, shut the bathroom door, and I got out of the bath and I put the towel around myself like a dress. To this day, I still have no idea how or what made me think to do that. It was just something that I instinctively did, and it felt right. And at the time, I didn't question it. I ended up twirling around thinking, yeah, it's a dress. And then I got just dried myself and then went downstairs. So that's my first thought of there's something in that. Whenever I look back at that moment, I think, well, there was clearly something there. But unfortunately, you push it down because, like I was saying, as you grow up, you recognise that it's almost like we're given predetermined roles and paths in life. As a second generation, born over here with my sister and my brother, we had certain expectations of the family. My parents came over from Hong Kong many years ago, and they brought over with them their traditions, and we were expected to uphold those traditions. But being born here, that was the first conflict, because I'm thinking, that doesn't align with what I'm being taught at school. But then I also had this other conflict that I don't align with the other boys in the schools. What do I do? Who am I? So that has been my journey throughout much of my life. Even in the workplace, that was still the same sort of thing. I was playing a role. I was expected to be this person. And yeah, I just found different ways to play that role. I would always end up breaking down and having this complete meltdown because I couldn't do it. You know, like with anything that's forced upon you, you crumble because you can only keep up that pretense for so long. I would crumble, and just for those listening who may be triggered by discussion of mental health and suicide, I would hit rock bottom, I would self-harm, I would try suicide, and then I'd wake up the next morning in hospital and I'd pick myself up, I would go back, find another role, and basically my thought was maybe that role wasn't right for me. Maybe I'll try this role. Maybe this one will work out and I can stick with it longer until whatever expiration date I put on myself. So it was that kind of up and down throughout my adult life, and I just buried who I was. And it wasn't until I came out 5 years ago when I realized this has been with me for a long time now. What is it about me that I can never fully understand or get to grips with? In the back of my mind, I knew, but denial is such a powerful thing. So I ended up taking time out after tour, being a musician back then. I took time out from music to think about who I am, why I felt this way. And that's when I came to the realization I am trans. I've always been trans, and there's nothing I can do to escape that. So I embraced it and I thought, I'm just going to give myself a chance. And 5 years on, I'm still here and I'm doing all I can to help others so that they don't necessarily need to go through that sort of trauma. That if we can open up a world where it's a lot more inclusive, it's a lot more accepting, mental health will be a lot better, because there isn't that impact of denial, control over ourselves, control from other people of who we should be. And that will impact so many other marginalized groups too.
Yeah, we're humans, aren't we? And we all just want to belong and be accepted for who we are. And yeah, when you're younger, often that means, especially as child of an immigrant, you know, my parents are from India, but I was born here as well. You're sort of trying to fit in and how that happens and be accepted and belong. But I think you mentioned today when you were speaking to our medical students about that, remembering that intersectional aspect, because we were talking about inclusion, health and access for vulnerable groups or groups that aren't always included. So our homeless patients or refugees or asylum seekers and what we can do. I think there are so many overlapping constructs about our own identity that form that. And
And when we look at intersectionality, I always see it as like a Venn diagram, but it's not static, because there are social issues that will affect different parts of our identity. So, you know, for me at the moment, I'm relatively new at being trans, 5 years in the grand scheme of things compared to how old I am or others that have walked this path before me. 5 years isn't that much, and I'm still getting to grips with it. I'm still learning about myself every day. But more importantly, trans rights are under attack all over the world, certainly here in the UK with the threat of legislation being rolled back, constant media attacks. So for me, my trans identity is at the forefront right now, and that's the one that needs more focus. But then there are other aspects like my religion, my background, working class background even. It's not just the colour of our skin. You know, we go through life with things that do affect us. And when we look in a healthcare setting, it's important to understand every patient's journey and how they got to where they are before they step through your door, because that will help you to understand their needs, any struggles they may have, any accessibility needs, and that will help us all to be better because we understand and we relate.
This sounds really obvious, but it's just echoing what you've just said, that we don't know the other person and they've just walked through our door, and so it's about getting to know them. If anything, you know, just listening to your story, I think, is... and your journey, and I know that's your particular journey as an individual, but I think that really helps our kind of students and our GP educators, because there's a lot of education that probably needs to be happening.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is happening and slowly, but it's sort of coming through. But so I'm delighted that actually our medical students are getting an education that I didn't have as a medical student. So that... it's a little win, but it is progress.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's change is incremental. It comes through progress. We can't all just wake up one day and think, you know, everything suddenly changed, because the world just doesn't work like that. You know, our current society is built up of all these unwritten rules piled on top of each other. And as, you know, with each generation that passes, there are more unwritten rules piled on. So things like blue for boys, pink for girls, you know, boys do this, boys don't cry, pink girls wear dresses. We need to unpack that. But because there's so much on top of it, it will take time to kind of delve deeper and challenge and unlearn. So it is always progress. I always say we always have the power to create change individually ourselves, because we all see through a very specific lens. And the moment we stop to think about others and what it could be for those people, that's when we start. It's almost like one of those spot the difference puzzles as a kid. we're taught when we do those puzzles to look for differences. That's great, but you know, at the same time, that could harbour difference. It can highlight difference, but let's use that for good. Let's look for the difference and find out what else we can do to celebrate that difference, to include that difference. Don't just leave it.
And something you said to our students that really stuck out for me today was about that trans people are people.
Yeah.
Yeah, full stop. And let's normalise who we are. So I think differences, great and should be celebrated. Mm. But as you say, not to exclude people.
Yeah. Focus on the noun, not the adjective. Because we're people. Doesn't matter what we look like. Does not matter what our choices are. It does not affect the other person. You don't have to understand somebody's choices to respect them. And the more that we can celebrate difference, the more we can create a world where we're just not shocked anymore. Like one of the examples I used earlier was tattoos. Tattoos used to be shocking. It used to be, you know, reserved for sailors, hookers, or, you know, sketchy people of society. But now, like, one in four people have a tattoo. When you say, "I have a tattoo," most people now are like, "Who cares? So what? Who doesn't?" That has become so normalized that it's boring. It's no longer a hot topic. And visibility is so important for helping that change, because someone might see me in the street, they might mock me, they might laugh at me. They'll go back, you know, if they're going to see, I don't know, a friend at a pub, for example, they might say to the friend, "I saw this man in a dress on the way here." They'll have a laugh, they'll have a giggle. If they see another trans person, they have another conversation, fine. But sooner or later, that conversation will get dull. It's not news anymore. Visibility is so powerful for that change. And again, you know, that change comes slowly, gradually, with us all chipping away at those unwritten rules.
I was just thinking about your social media presence and, you know, how important that is. And you said, actually, it's a way to bring people together. And I wonder whether if some of that negativity, because I'm sure there's lots of negative stuff on social media, how do you balance that?
That's a good question. Social media is so good, but so bad at the same time. You know, it's great because it brings people together. We only have to look at the global pandemic where we were essentially housebound. Social media was our way of connecting. That was great because for those who are isolated, they had that connection. They could form those relationships. But it's also bad because you're behind a screen, behind a keyboard, behind a phone. You can hurl abuse at somebody with little repercussions. And that's incredibly dangerous. And that must be challenged wherever possible. But at the same time, we shouldn't let that stop us from having those positive connections. Because I've met so many great people on social media who've become really, really great friends in real life. And if it wasn't for social media, I wouldn't have come out when I did. Because I remember seeing somebody post and their story really resonated with me, and I saw parts of myself within their journey, and it did really inspire me to then seek out others. And that's when I realised, I'm not a freak. I'm not the only one who feels this way. Why have I been telling this to myself all my life? We are, in the UK, we're still roughly 1% of the UK population, but that's still quite a lot of people. And when we look at worldwide, we're everywhere. We've always been part of society. It's just, you know, society's been a bit whitewashed over the years and everything's become really binary in other cultures. Gender difference and various genders have been revered throughout time. It's only through colonization that everything's been very, very diluted, I think I would say, whereas everything's this or that and simplified. But we're human beings, and as any medical professional know, human beings are incredibly complex. We can't really be trying to put a human being through a certain shape, like with those kids' toys. We have to let human beings be human.
And there is something about finding people whose stories you resonated with online, probably a community online that maybe didn't exist face to face, or maybe it did for you, but you know, having another community and people that understood, you could see bits of yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's so vital for any community, because we're scattered and we're afraid. We're not always visible, so the social media networks and the platforms, they offer an element of safety where we don't have to expose ourselves by being visible when we meet up in person, we can do so from the safety of our own home, our own comfort bubble, and use that to tentatively step out as our authentic selves. As it was my best friend who actually convinced me to start an Instagram page before I came out. And she basically said, you've been this person for so long, why not set up a new Instagram page and just put you, as you are now, out there? And I was so scared of that. But then it was quite empowering as well, because I could finally say, this is me from the comfort of my own home. And when we look at hate, especially online hate, don't forget that we have a choice. We can choose whether we engage, whether we respond, or sometimes the stupid, really dumb questions or comments, I'll leave there because I don't need to say anything. They've hung themselves by posting it. Anybody else that comes across that in the comments will laugh. They might look at that and think, what an idiot. We have that power. And by becoming enraged, we relinquish that power. We let them win, and hate should never win. So it's a reaction, and it's down to us to choose how we react. We can't control what's been said or thrown at us. I recently received death threats on one of my Instagram posts. As much as social media platforms don't do enough to tackle online hate, I can, and that's through my choice of actions.
And I think as an adult, you are in a place where you are kind of your authentic self and able to make those choices. I was listening to a podcast about young people and social media, and that sort of breaks my heart when actually it's someone who maybe is in a position where they can't control that. So I do think there is something about accountability for sure.
Absolutely.
I wonder whether we could move on to your experiences of healthcare and accessing it, and thinking about the fact that we'll have, educators who are also clinicians listening to this podcast, and understanding what barriers were for you, what actually went well, a bit about your journey. So
yeah,
what we can do better, really.
When I came out, I went to my GP and I asked for a referral to my chosen gender clinic. I had to do a lot of research myself before that point because I was scared what the GP's response would be. I'd read a lot that GPs don't know that much about the process. So I thought, okay, well, this is my one-time chance. I don't want this horrible, anticlimax. So I did a lot of research and I went in and I said, okay, this is my chosen gender clinic. I know that it's not based on postcode. I can pick anyone. And I chose the one with the least waiting time. Back then it was about 18 months. But as soon as my referral went through, it shot up. And, 5 years later, I'm still waiting for my first appointment. My GP, she's been fantastic. And I credit her so much with what I know about the healthcare system, because she talks to me openly and honestly about the system whilst understanding and hearing my needs. Because there is no mental health support whilst you're waiting. You're on a list indefinitely, and you just have to wait for a letter to pop through the door one day and say, here's your appointment, it will be on this date. You now have, I think they give you a few days to respond, and if they don't hear back from you, the appointment goes to somebody else. So it's waiting for that lotto ticket win almost. You're constantly checking, constantly waiting, and that's no way to live. So I would say to anybody in the healthcare sector that you can all make a difference, because you all have a voice, and if you use that voice collectively, you reach out and you support one another, you can implement little changes, whether it's healthcare, whether it's making the process to obtain a new NHS number a lot smoother without the patient having to constantly educate, constantly explain themselves over and over, only to be met with a brick wall. Because I do know, unfortunately, some medical professionals feel quite threatened when a patient tells them what the process is. And when you don't have that relationship, it can be incredibly difficult. So always let the patient lead, let them guide you, and then use empathy and use your own knowledge and experience to think, well, what can I do to support them in the meantime? You can lobby, various groups, local government, you can lobby organisations to create change where you see there is a gap and you think it shouldn't be like that.
Obviously, as a job in GP, I deal with kind of the after effects of people waiting for appointments. Mm. And I'm aware of long waiting lists, and I'm aware the system is struggling, and post-COVID, things are worse. And I can understand that. But 5 years, as you said to our students today, it's enough to kind of grow a doctor, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yet you are still waiting. I don't know, it just makes me feel anxious just listening to that. That whole thing of, you know, you have to get an appointment and then you have to answer back to say, yes, I can attend. And if you miss that, then do you go to the bottom of the waiting list? No one's going to... I mean, it's filling me with anxiety. It's just not acceptable. It's not good enough, is it?
And it's horrible. And you are constantly in limbo. You don't know where you can... Sometimes you don't even know if you need to move house, where you can move to. If I'm registered at a certain GP, like my wife and I, we moved house during the first lockdown. We were torn, where do we go? And I basically phoned up my GP and said, what's your catchment area? And we had to look for somewhere to live within that catchment area, because I was in a very lucky and really privileged position where my GP was open to working with a private healthcare provider on a shared care basis. She was very proactive in checking up on me, making sure I'm okay. And I didn't want to lose that, because I do know that not everyone is as lucky, but I was still restricted to living within a certain area. And what if I move further afield? My wife and I were thinking about moving to Manchester. Well, that's now going to be 2 hours further away from my chosen gender clinic. Should my appointment suddenly pop through the door, I then have, you know, instead of a 3-hour drive to it, I'll have a 5-hour drive. So it holds us back because we just can't get on with our lives. And it's horrible. I'm not the only one. And I know that at the moment, I certainly won't be the last one. And all we can do is use our experience to highlight this and push for change when, you know, as patients, we should be expected to know what that change should look like. But we can certainly use our experience to say, well, this is how it is for me. Let's do something about it.
And I was also aware that you said that you were in a position where you were able to or had to access private treatment to support this, because you've been waiting for such a long time. And there are people that don't have that as an option. So
it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I lost a friend earlier this year to the wait. Sadly, they just felt they couldn't hang on any longer. There's so much wrong with the system as it is, and indeed, you know, not just trans healthcare but other areas as well. However, trans healthcare is the one that's openly measured in years rather than months or weeks. And it's just a supply and demand model that never recognised that the demand will grow. It's not a trend where more people come out and then everyone decides, I'll give that a go. It's like, you know, many, many years ago when being left-handed was horrible. You know, you were punished for being left-handed. And when it became a lot more acceptable, you were no longer punished or you weren't hit at school for using the wrong hand. Suddenly there was a boom of left-handed people. And that wasn't a trend. It was just suddenly people thought, I can come forward now. In the case of trans people, it's, I have to come forward now because otherwise I might not be here. And a lot of the time I can safely say that through talking to so many others, we come out through necessity, not necessarily through choice.
It's really hard. And so I'm just thinking, in the middle of all that system level change that needs to happen, the little things we can do and our students can do in our surgeries. And you were talking to the students today about screening, for example. One thing we did at our practice recently, which I have to say I'm really proud of because I think it makes a big difference, is just looking at the wording when we're inviting people in for cervical screening and just saying it's for those of you with a cervix rather than women or females, and acknowledging that you may not be on the national screening invite. And how do we have systems where we can prompt and, you know, we can have reminders to say, actually, you are due a smear, because you were saying otherwise the responsibility is left to
back
you.
On us, yeah. And, you know, as patients, we don't know. When I started HRT, I was explained the basics. You know, HRT effects can do this, can do that. Here are some of the risks. But it's quite basic. You know, no one at any point then says, oh, well, you know, as breast tissue develops, you've got to be careful and this is how you check yourself. There's none of that. And even though we're a relatively low risk, it's still a risk. So, yeah, GPs and anybody in primary care can really use that opportunity, seize that and say, you know, there's a gap here. What can we do to fill that gap? And not be afraid to share, because all GPs are essentially little private practices. There is an overarching, you know, body that pays, that, you know, subsidizes. But don't be afraid at conferences to share what you've achieved and work together, because that's the only way that you can create that progress, but move it forward quicker.
Like you say, I think it's remembering the voice that we have, the privilege, the power, the what we can do to change things. And this was from someone saying, yeah, we need to focus on doing some quality improvement projects at our surgery. And this was one of the outcomes.
That's fantastic.
And the other thing that I learned from you today that I am going to go check up is pronouns, whether we include that. You know, do we just have binary male, female genders on our registration forms? How easy we make it for people? So I'm going to, that's my on my to-do list to go back and check at my surgery. And so I just wanted to thank you for being so honest and helping us to educate our students and GP teachers and nurse educators and other medical educators. And what your kind of final take-home message or messages would be when it comes to us looking after our patients who, yeah, our trans patients and thinking about trans health.
It's important to understand that every trans experience, every trans journey is incredibly unique. They're like fingerprints. No two journeys will ever be the same. But also, trans people have become so medicalized recently that we need to move away from that. You know, I understand that in legislation, for example, the Equality Act, Gender Recognition Act, it still uses outdated language such as sex change. Sex and gender are two separate things. And when you've got language like that in legislation, then it just causes confusion. So being very clear and understanding differences is one thing. But also understanding that just because, you know, I'm trans, for example, I made these choices for myself. Yes, I chose to go on HRT. Yes, I chose breast augmentation. But the next trans woman that you or another professional might speak to or help might not want HRT, because we're not defined by the medical transition. The medical transition simply helps us to ease the dysphoria. It aligns our, you know, gender identity with our bodies. But there, I know some fantastic people who are so inspiring, and they've come out, but they, you know, they're comfortable in that body, and they don't feel that they need HRT at the moment. So it's to recognise that let the patient tell you what they want. We all know what's on offer, but that doesn't mean that it's a conveyor belt where you hop on at the start, you go through diagnosis, you go through HRT, you go through gender confirmation surgery, and you pop off the other end of the conveyor belt, and it's like suddenly, you know, that's the final result. Some people may want that. Brilliant. Some people may hop on the conveyor belt and then hop off and then back on again later on in life when they feel ready, because we've got to think about financial privilege, what their family life is like, what their support is like, whether they're ready mentally to be able to do that. But there's no real order, you know, from what the typical guidelines are. WPATH publishes the standards of care, and it's all in there, you know, the best ways that's internationally recognised to treat and deal with trans patients. But that's just a guideline. It's not the be-all and end-all. So to any professionals, I would definitely say, take the time to learn about what you can do, but what you can do is not necessarily what you have to do. Always ask the patient.
I think that's a brilliant place to end on. It's just made me focus on the person in front of me and their journey, and just remembering life is kind of about that journey and not necessarily the sort of final outcome. And staying, part of our role, I think, is to stay with people on the journey, yeah, in the way that it sounds like your GP has done. So thank you again for joining us, and I am sure that people will find this a really interesting and valuable listen.
Thank you for having me.
Very welcome.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. Tweet at us at KUMEC4KCL on Twitter. Thank you for listening. See you next time.